Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. In our first case this morning, 2023-0471, in the matter of disciplinary counsel versus Mark Stewart Bennett. On behalf of the respondent, Mr. Penvos. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My name is Brian Penvos, and I have the honor of representing respondent Mark Bennett before you this morning. Respectfully, I ask that we reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, this matter comes to you today before on the issue of determination of appropriate sanction, which we respectfully suggest is a fully stayed 6-month suspension from the practice of law. Mr. Bennett, from the beginning of this process, disciplinary process, has accepted full responsibility and been remorseful for his misconduct, admitting all facts in the complaint to which misconduct he reported initially, and then further entered into a consent agreement stipulating to all facts once again, stipulating to misconduct of a Rule 8.4H violation. A lawyer shall not engage in any other conduct that adversely reflects on the lawyer's fitness to practice law. And jointly with the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, made a joint recommendation that the sanction be a stayed 6-month suspension. When the panel later rejected that consent agreement, Mr. Bennett, a third time, admitted the facts, stipulated to all facts in relator's complaint, stipulated to the 2 aggravating factors present and the 4 mitigation factors present in this matter, stipulated to the Rule 8.4H violation, and jointly with the relator recommended a stayed suspension of 6 months from the practice of law. To our bewilderment, we don't understand. The Office of Disciplinary Counsel has abandoned that joint position in favor of the recommendation of the board of an actual 6-month suspension from the practice of law. Now, just as a matter to note, as I'm sure you're familiar with the facts, for today's purposes, to protect the individual impacted by Mr. Bennett's impact, we're going to refer to that person by their initials, JS. And as we have a discussion about sanction, we'd like to remind the oft-stated purpose of the disciplinary process is to protect the public from lawyers, and I think this part's important, who are unworthy of the trust and confidence essential to the attorney-client relationship. And keeping that purpose in mind, we believe that the board reached beyond the facts in the record as stipulated and presented through testimony at the hearing, and further cited inapplicable case law that did not compare to the facts, the misconduct, the sole violation, and the aggravating and mitigating factors present here, in order to reach to make a recommendation of an actual 6-month suspension.
Counsel, doesn't the record in this case reflect, or it was alleged, and I don't know if there was a specific finding, that there was an actual touching by your client of the person involved?
That's correct, Justice Donnelly. There was an act where what was stipulated was that while in a law library working together in the United States Attorney's Office, where JS was a law clerk and Mr. Bennett was an assistant United States attorney, reached upward for a sentencing guideline book and brushed across the front of JS. And what was stipulated is that JS believed that act to be intentional and that Mr. Bennett held his gaze on that act. That was the single act of touching. No other touching occurred in that time frame.
Wouldn't that meet the elements of a sexual imposition charge?
No. And under the law, we believe because it was the back of an arm and the back of a hand, that was not done for sexual gratification. This is not a case like the Quatman case where a person was groped.
Except I believe he stared at her the entire time he did that.
That was stipulated, Justice Bruner. Yes.
That doesn't change the characterization of it being accidental?
Mr. Bennett's belief, again, what's in the record and what's been stipulated is JS believed it to be intentional. Mr. Bennett's recollection, this is beyond the record, but since you asked the question, is that he doesn't have a clear recollection of the event. But he is always, out of great sensitivity for JS throughout this matter and admitting responsibility, has said, if she said it happened, then that's happened. And it impacted her and it harmed her, and I'm sorry. But no, I don't believe it changes the character of being sexual imposition or groping. So what we believe the board did in reaching is, they cite in paragraph 66 of the report that they were troubled by, quote, evidence that other colleagues had similar experiences. Now, please keep in mind that this matter has had nothing to do with anything other than the conduct and interaction between Mr. Bennett and JS and no other persons. It was not brought forward in the complaint. It was not prepared for in the hearing. JS did not testify live. Rather, their joint exhibits 1 and 2 are transcripts of the federal employment investigation conducted by the Office of an Attorney General, in which she provided interviews to the investigating agent and made comments that, quite frankly, border on hearsay about things she may have heard. And the board reaches out to seize that and say that it's troubled in order to reach for that enhanced sanction. And it's frankly unfair, because it's beyond the protections of due process, have an ability to challenge those or cross-examine. JS did not testify live. The panel did not have the ability to hear from her and weigh her credibility. And so, as this court oft does, you know, the panel is the one who hears the testimony, defers to that witness. That should not be the case relative to that statement.
Except JS was pretty open about the fact that she didn't initially report it because she thought that's just, that you just have to put up with that. And then she said, and maybe I have a flirtatious personality. So, I mean, even though there may not have been the benefit of live cross-examination, I mean, she admitted that there were things that could mitigate. Does that have any bearing on this?
From our view, and yes, you're correct, the facts are stipulated as the reasons why she articulated during the OIG investigation as to why she did not come forward. Keep in mind, during two stints, separate stints as a law clerk with the United States Attorney's Office. But again, being sensitive to her experiences and the harm that she's been caused, Mr. Bennett has stipulated to those reasons. And, you know, we're not walking back from owning responsibility, so please let me be clear about this and just saying that Mr. Bennett, much like the facts in Judge Barry's case, believed that the conduct wasn't unwelcomed or not okay. He understands now through his mental health counseling that it's not okay and that there were professional boundaries that need to be in place and followed. But at the time, because of the statements that you referred to, Justice Bruner, that JS had a flirtatious personality, that she made jokes about, such as being his mistress, he incorrectly, Mr. Bennett, believed that that the conduct was welcome. Clearly not. But yeah, we think that that does have some mitigating effect here.
So Mr. Bennett was in a society that allowed him to have sort of an elevated status in that legal community. And JS was in a position where she's trying to work her way through to build a legal career. And it appears from the record that she went to great lengths to avoid him, especially trying to get the second stint, but also knew that to get, you know, to basically leverage what she had, she also had to deal with him. You know, when we're looking at young lawyers coming out of law school, entering the practice of law, should we say that that is okay, what she had to go through?
Absolutely not, and we've stipulated to that misconduct. And please understand that there's what we've stipulated to and what Mr. Bennett knows and understands now and what he knew and understood then. And he was not aware, it's not in the record because we've entered into stipulations that she took practices to avoid and work at other desks so that she wouldn't run across them. We've stipulated to that, and that's not okay.
Yeah, like driving 2 hours to a different office so she didn't have to work in the same office where he was.
Yes, we stipulated to that. But again, in the time, to give it context, Mr. Bennett was unaware that it was because if it was anything that he was doing was offensive or unwelcome. But to your question, no, it's not okay. But we should look at, and as we've briefed extensively, both relator and respondent, and in this court's line of precedence in the Mismus and Skolnick cases, for example, is whether or not whether the attorney had direct supervisory authority over the law clerk or the paralegal. In this situation, it was not. They were co-workers. He had general authority on a project-to-project basis, but he had no ability to hire, fire, or promote, much as Mr. Skolnick or Mr. Mismus, more akin to the situation with Judge Barry. And all parties agree. And the board agrees. Mr. Bennett's conduct does not rise to the level of offensiveness as found in the Skolnick and Mismus matters. And we also, I want to lift up uniquely, and I think in this matter that I'm not aware of another precedent, the mitigating factor of the imposition of other penalties and sanctions. Because they were co-workers, because they didn't have that, he did not possess that authority to hire, fire, and promote, she made complaint for his wrongful conduct. An investigation was conducted, and he ended up losing his job. And we're not saying we should feel bad for him, but this was his dream job. He spent 13 years serving our country in the Department of Justice, prosecuting terrorists and economic criminals and large drug organizations. And this is where he wanted to finish his career, and he lost it. And why do I mention that? Because it differs in comparison to all the other lines of cases. When we look at Skolnick or Mismus, where they worked for themselves. There wasn't going to be this internal process. They weren't going to lose their jobs. And frankly, after serving their suspension, which was 1 year, 6 months stayed, the same amount of actual time that the board is recommending being suspended and time out for Mr. Bennett here, even though it's not a direct supervisory case, even though the conduct is not offensive, they could return to those jobs afterwards. The same with Judge Barry. He was an elected official. Mr. Bennett was not appointed. He was not the United States attorney for the Northern District of Ohio. He was an employee, and he lost his job because of that, and we think that's imperative here. And then we'd also point that the board, in its effort to reach for this heightened sanction of an actual suspension, then cites inapplicable, uncomparable case law from the view of counsel. We start with the Campbell case. The Campbell case is 30 years old, where the misconduct occurred over the span of 14 years, both while the attorney was a private practicing attorney and a judge, like Judge Barry, held to a higher standard of integrity of protecting the system. And that occurred with multiple women, all of whom Judge Campbell had direct supervisory authority or who appeared in his courtroom. There were six violations, not one violation, as in this matter.
Did Judge Barry touch anyone?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did Judge Barry touch anyone?
He did not touch anyone. He did not touch anyone. That is a distinguishing factor between here and this, but there are all other factors that distinguish Judge Barry's case that suggest Mr. Bennett should receive the same sanction. And quite frankly, it's the existence of the mitigating factors present. I lift up for you, again, the imposition of other sanctions and penalties, though not introduced as formal mitigation evidence of Government Rule Bar Rule 13C7, of mental health disorder. Before these process even commenced, Mr. Bennett asked himself, why did I act this way? Why did I do this? I'm embarrassed. And voluntarily, before even reporting his conduct to disciplinary counsel, commenced counseling so that he could understand why he behaved the way he did, so that he could understand how in the future to set up appropriate boundaries, professional boundaries, and so that he could be ensured that he would not repeat his misconduct in the future. And his mental health professional, Christy Sugarman, opined, and it is stipulated into the evidence, that she believes it's unlikely that he will repeat this behavior and that he currently possesses the requisite competent and ethical ability to engage in the practice of law.
And you're into your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kanai, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court.
Counsel, before you start, I just want to understand from opposing counsel, what was agreed to and what wasn't?
Both at the consent to hear, or sorry, the consent to discipline and the stipulated recommendations were a fully stayed 6-month suspension. Both parties agreed to that at the time.
Okay, what happened?
So essentially, Your Honor, this comes down to a matter of interpretation. When we drafted the consent to discipline and the stipulations, we were looking at Ms. Moss and Barry, and we were comparing those two lines of cases. We interpreted those cases as Ms. Moss stands for the proposition, sorry.
But you agreed to that?
Yes, we did.
To the 6 months stayed?
Yes, we did.
Is your word not important?
It is, Your Honor. But what's more important is that we respect the system of justice, and we considered after the stipulations were rejected, the board issued an opinion that interpreted this court's cases, I believe, differently than the way we had originally interpreted them. So specifically, when looking at Ms. Moss, we felt that the key difference between Ms. Moss and disciplinary counsel versus Barry, that is 1 year with 6 months stayed and a fully stayed, was that Ms. Moss had supervisory authority, as that term is traditionally understood, and Barry had no authority whatsoever over the court reporter in that case. And so we looked at that as essentially a binary type of decision. It falls in the Ms. Moss bucket or it falls in the Barry bucket. Here, there's no question that Mr. Bennett did not have traditional supervisory authority over JS.
So that'd be like Barry?
Yes.
Okay.
But in Barry, there was no touching. Didn't that resonate with your office? There was an actual touching, that something, I've seen people be charged with sexual imposition for that same type of behavior by the state.
It was certainly something that we were cognizant of, Your Honor. But again, what we were trying to decide is how to interpret the existing precedent, and we keyed on that distinction of traditional supervisory authority. So, Justice Fischer, the thing that changed was, after the board issued their opinion, I believe they interpreted this court's cases much more aggressively than we had, and instead of looking at Barry and Ms. Moss as a set of dichotomous choices, they looked at it as a spectrum.
A continuum.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Okay. And
well, can Mr. Bennett's case fall then somewhere between there? There doesn't really seem to be an in-between.
Well, I do believe that actually there is an in-between if we take out as we were looking at it more of as almost a bright line rule. There's either traditional supervisory authority or there isn't. If you take away that rule and ask, really, I think what the board did is, what is the practical relationship between these two people and what is the harm to the victim in this case? Then I think what we see is that this case does move more towards Ms. Moss. Mr. Bennett was a well-connected, award-winning senior federal prosecutor at the prestigious office of the United States Attorney's Office. JS was a 23-year-old law clerk aspiring to become an attorney who had indicated that her dream was to work at the Department of Justice. In that regard, although Mr. Bennett could not fire JS, he had an incredible amount of sway over her potential future career options. And that's clear. He even leveraged that sway against JS when he asked her, for example, when she wanted to come back to the office and he asked her what he would get in exchange for helping, what she was willing to do for his assistance.
And I understand that analysis, but wouldn't the end result, if we were to agree with your position now, the penalty would be closer to that of the Ms. Moss case?
Yes.
It would actually be in technically identical, not theoretically because of the 6 months stayed and 6 months out, but the actual, on paper it would be different, but in all actuality it would be the same. So do you feel that Mr. Bennett's conduct does rise to the level, if you agree it doesn't rise to the level of the misconduct, should it rise to the level of the same sanction?
We agree that it does. So
think it does rise to the same
yes.
level?
Yes. After the board issued their report and recommendation, we reconsidered our position.
But you're not asking for a year suspension.
Well, we do acknowledge that the board, I think, was correct when it indicated that Mr. Bennett's conduct was similar to, but not as egregious as Ms. Moss's conduct. And there are obviously ways of interpreting that. Ms. Moss's conduct was much more overtly and patently offensive. He was much more direct in his demands for sexual favors and much more direct in his expression of what the consequences would be if his victim did not comply.
And there was supervisory authority.
Yes, and there was supervisory authority.
But technically you're asking for the exact same penalty.
We're asking for a six-month fully stayed suspension without the additional imposition of the 1 year, or sorry, a six-month actual suspension without the addition of the 6 months that was stayed in Ms. Moss. So Ms. Moss received a 1 year suspension with 6 months stayed.
And here you're asking for, he had 1 year, 6 months stayed, which means 6 months out, and here you're asking for 6 months out.
Yes,
technically the same sanction.
It is a lesser sanction. I mean,
absolutely, you're right. It's not a year suspension. But for purposes of not being able to work as a lawyer, you're asking for the identical sanction.
Yes, we're asking for the same amount of time out. And we are recognizing that we believe that the board was correct in making that recommendation, reducing the Ms. Moss sentence essentially as far as it could without getting rid of the fully, or without getting rid of the actual time out. I mean, there is no other option below 6 months. And so the board gave the least sanction that it could, thereby giving some credit under what was given in Ms. Moss.
Counsel, when you say supervisory authority, what do you mean by that?
So essentially the traditional definition would be the ability to hire, fire, promote, or demote in an immediate supervisory capacity. Mr. Bennett does not have, or did not have, those powers at the time. And so JS would have reported to a different attorney who would have had that authority.
So distinguish that with Judge Barry.
So Judge Barry had no supervisory authority over the law clerk in his case.
You don't believe those court reporters work for that court?
Those court reporters do not report to Judge Barry.
Directly, but they run the director of that court, those judges, correct?
Yes.
I'm having difficulty not believing that that judge had supervisory authority over a court reporter.
Well, I believe that, so again, what we looked at were the federal analogs to supervisory authority, because there aren't really, this distinction isn't made in disciplinary cases in Ohio. And we believe that the authority the judges have over court reporters is a very real authority, but it is similar to the type of authority, again, that pilots have over flight attendants and doctors have over nurses. They can certainly impact the careers of those people, but they are not, in the traditional sense, direct reports to them. And so there is a layer between a doctor and a nurse or a judge and a court reporter, particularly a court reporter who isn't even in that judge's courtroom, which was the case in Barry. This was not his court reporter. It was a court reporter in a different judge's courtroom. And so because you have that attenuated relationship, Judge Barry would not have had the ability to hire, fire, promote, or demote the court reporter in any direct way. It's possible he could have influenced her future prospects through giving her a negative review or discussing that with a supervisor, but that's the same non-supervisory authority that doctors have over nurses and pilots over flight attendants in the
public. But her supervisor reports to the judges.
Yes, that is. I don't know the exact makeup of the court, Your Honor. I apologize. That wasn't an issue that came up in the record in Barry. I would assume that is true, yes.
Okay.
I guess I'm struggling with that, too. I mean, it seems in the Barry case, you have a judge. You have a court reporter who works for the court. She works for the entire court. You have a judge who isn't the only vote on hiring and firing, but he has the authority, he's part of the authority that makes the decision to hire or fire someone, whereas in this case, you have a U.S. attorney who has no hiring or firing authority at all. So, I mean, how is, it seems it's the exact opposite of what you suggest. Judge Barry would have a lot more authority over someone who works for the entire court than a U.S. attorney would have, assistant U.S. attorney would have for someone who works for the Department of Justice is hired and fired by the head U.S. attorney?
I think there are two answers to that question. First, Your Honor, while the court reporter does work for the court and the judge has obviously some authority over that, I think even Barry recognized that the court reporter was not an employee for Judge Barry in the Barry decision. It did acknowledge that
But he's part of the termination authority. I mean, that's not the case here.
That is true. That is not the case here. But what is the case here is that Mr. Bennett, because of the specific relationship that he had, which is a senior attorney and a law clerk, Mr. Bennett had a significantly greater influence over JS than he would have had if JS had been, I think, as Mr. Bennett's counsel characterized it, merely a coworker. This is not a...
And that's certainly true, but that doesn't... That doesn't really help with the Berry distinction.
I believe it does when we look, again, as if we're looking at Berry as a guidepost, and even the board acknowledged in its consideration that Judge Berry had no authority whatsoever over the court reporter in that case. So if we take that as its position, that Judge Berry has the least amount of supervisory authority that we would normally expect, and Ms. Moss, for example, is a solo practitioner with a law clerk, has the greatest amount of supervisory authority.
But again, I do not understand how, when you do this continuum, you say that Judge Berry has the least amount of supervisory authority when you're dealing with an employee who works for the court, and he is one of the members of the court who can make decisions on hiring, firing, or anything else to do with that.
And Your Honor, I can't really discuss.
That's like saying the member that a board of directors of a corporation has no authority over the CEO, which simply isn't true.
No, I believe, Your Honor, it's actually more like saying that a board of directors in a corporation is not the direct supervisory authority for a line employee in that corporation. That is a more direct analogy.
That's fair.
And generally speaking, the board of directors does not hire, fire, promote, or demote line employees. There is usually a direct supervisory authority, what we consider the traditional supervisory authority, an immediate supervisor with immediate powers to do that, who is expected to do that as part of their routine and day-to-day operation. Typically, and again, I apologize because I don't necessarily know the makeup of the Hamilton County Common Pleas Court, but typically that would be a chief court reporter or a head court reporter or someone with a specific title whose job it is to assign and to manage the court reporters.
But regardless of that question, the board found that Judge Berry was able to exert power over that court reporter who was a person associated with the justice system, and that's what the board found. And I do think that's justifiable, don't you?
Yes. Yes.
And so wouldn't Bennett's situation really be very analogous to this?
Where
JS is not someone he had direct authority over, but he's able to exert power over her in that same system where they work.
Yes, but I believe his authority is more direct than it is in Judge Berry's case. And that is because, as I said, we have examples in this case of him using his authority to, for example, when JS asked for a recommendation and he responded with sexually suggestive innuendo. And additionally, JS put up with more direct solicitations than we have in Berry. Judge Berry asked the court reporter, I believe, out to lunch, maybe dinner, maybe drinks. And that is essentially the extent of what he did directly with her. The rest of them were messages that he sent her that were crude and offensive or partisan in nature. But Mr. Bennett, in this case, asked JS to send him nude pictures of herself. He questioned her choice in boyfriends and suggested that he could be her sexual partner. He touched her inappropriately. He withheld routine professional favors in favor of sexually suggestive innuendo. So his actions were much more direct, and his ability to influence her potential future career, either in the DOJ or not, was I think, much more immediate.
All those factors you just outlined, why the consent agreement? How often do you do consent agreements? Why not leave it up to the board?
Right. I understand that, Your Honor. And again, as I said, I mean, there's nothing comfortable about admitting that we made a mistake. I believe that we did. When we looked at the board's recommendation, I think it was a better recommendation in terms of what the goal of the disciplinary system is and public policy. That was a mistake on our part, and there is, you know, I regret that. But I am also not going to come before this court and say that you should do something that I think now was wrong.
Let me ask a different question. Let's go to the merits a little bit.
Yep.
On this, whether you call it buckets or continuum, if I remember correctly, the ones that got the worst punishment were those who kept denying that anything happened, and those who said, yeah, I did something and stipulated to got less, right? Am I wrong about that?
Well, I mean, when Ms. Moss went into hearing, I believe he had stipulated his misconduct. He attempted to blame it on his
alcohol. He blamed it on others.
Right.
All right. But those that accepted that they had done something wrong tended to get the lower admonishments, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So in this case, no matter, I mean, what the guy did doesn't sound right to me, but he seems to have accepted, at least that's the argument from your colleague on the other side, that he's accepted his responsibility. Does that not militate in favor of the lower admonishment?
And counsel, to piggyback on that, not just accepted responsibility, self-reported, resigned from his job, cause less expense in investigation for disciplinary counsel, made sure his employer didn't have to go through the rest of the investigation. I don't recall reading a case where a lawyer in the case has done as much, if you will, to own up to his or her conduct and make this process as easy as possible, quite frankly, for disciplinary counsel. Does that, as Justice Fischer is saying, is that something that should weigh in on our decision?
Madam Chief Justice, I see I'm well past my time. May I answer?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Your Honors, yes. Obviously, it does count. We stipulate to the mitigating factors in this case. We fully believe that he should get full credit for his self-report, for his acceptance of his responsibility, and his cooperation during the disciplinary process. We understand that this issue would have likely come to us regardless of his self-report, as Mr. Bennett knows, but I don't think that mitigates against necessarily cancels out the fact that he has cooperated fully during the proceedings. The critical question in this case to us is whether the conduct is of such a nature that the board's recommendation of a 6-month suspension is appropriate. And given the full balance, there is no doubt that he took steps to remediate the issues, but there is also no doubt that for 16 months he sexually harassed a 23-year-old law clerk. And in doing so, he did so inside and outside of the office. He did so with offensive language, with conditions placed upon routine professional favors, and with an unwanted physical touching. We also point to the fact that although he claims to have fully accepted responsibility, he came to you today making a due process argument about the contents of the exhibits. Those were exhibits that he fully stipulated to. There's no due process argument here.
Well, wait a second. I mean, that really seems unfair for disciplinary counsel to say that someone has to, because they stipulate to the contents of exhibits, that they stipulate to the idea that there can be hearsay evidence used against them.
No, I do want to be clear.
That was his due process argument, right? He said these are statements that these are essentially hearsay statements. I mean, how is it inappropriate for someone to make an argument that we should consider hearsay? We do that in the legal system all the time. People don't give up their rights to make legal arguments simply because they stipulate to facts or reach an agreement with disciplinary counsel, an agreement that, frankly, that now disciplinary counsel has changed his mind about.
They absolutely do not give up their right, but due process is that Mr. Bennett has process. And those are the rules of evidence. The time to object to hearsay would have been before stipulating to the admissibility.
What he's objecting to is not the content of the exhibits. He's objecting to the fact that the panel made a substantive took a decision based upon hearsay statements. He didn't stipulate to that. He stipulated to what was in the exhibits.
Right. But essentially, what he's saying now is, I wanted the panel to consider some hearsay, but it considered hearsay that I didn't want to consider, even though I didn't object at the time I was to object. That means that, at best, he would be left with a plain error argument to this court.
Well, that's certainly not the way that I would understand the rules. I mean, certainly, we get depositions, things that have hearsay all the time, and we don't say we're going to consider them because they're part of the record.
Then, Your Honor, I apologize for wasting your time with that argument, but nonetheless, even if we accept that one sentence maybe in the board's 67-paragraph decision should be disregarded, Mr. Bennett still engaged in a course of conduct that is egregious and offensive and violates public policy and Ms. Moss and the very principles of Ms. Moss regarding a lawyer's duty to be a teacher and a mentor and a role model for law clerks. Based on that, we believe that the board's recommendation is fully consistent with Ms. Moss and that the six-month actual suspension is appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Penbos, a minute, 49 seconds.
Thank you, Chief Justice. You know, the fact of the matter is that the facts as stipulated in presenting the hearing haven't changed since the close of the evidence, regardless if ODC is going to change its position or not relative to this issue of sway or influence in the future. And the fact is that that evidence of sway, mind you, albeit, lawyers definitely have some influence, generally speaking, over young lawyers that they work with. There's no question. But there's no facts and evidence that suggest that he did sway her career in any way or that she was deterred from going on to have a career as a lawyer with the federal government even. And so I think this analogy of airline pilots and flight attendants and doctors and nurses is misplaced and falls short as to what the facts are here in evidence. And to make that reach, what the panel and the board did was looked at that antiquated, uncomparable Campbell case and looked at that little snippet of dicta to then reach to say he could have swayed JS's future and that therefore he should be actually suspended rather than receive a stayed suspension.
So let me ask you why. Yes. Why would she, after all the unpleasantness of what she had to deal with his messages, his touching, his comments to her inside and outside work through different social media, why would she feel that she needed to go back to him to get, and why would she put herself through the process of going back to him to get a letter of resignation? She was pretty much stuck, wasn't she?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, other than what we stipulated, that that's what she said. I know that she came back for two different stints and was there for a long time, and they continued to work on projects together until this investigation was launched. And I also want to address your, real quickly, your question about touching. Please look at the Quatman case. Please look at the Burkholder cases. Though attorney-client misconduct cases, whether or not appropriate to consider here, they received fully stayed suspensions, and there were acts of touching there.
I understand. And the other thing I wanted to ask you is the Department of Justice, I mean, this is an arm of the government, an arm of the United States government. It's an arm of the legal system that without the confidence in the legal system, we don't function in terms of the public having confidence in what we do. Isn't he held to a higher standard than what an attorney in private practice in their own solo practice would be?
I appreciate the question and the point. I don't know that there's case law that suggests that or supports that beyond just look at the general purpose of the attorney disciplinary system, which is to protect the trust and confidence in our judicial system, and particularly in relation to the trust and confidence that exists within an attorney-client relationship, which isn't
the circumstance. He was a prosecutor. He prosecutes sex crimes.
I understand, Your Honor. But I do think there's a distinction between prosecutors and, you know, whether or not they're held to heightened standards in misconduct cases, for example, where they withhold exculpatory evidence. That's not the circumstance here, compared to a situation with Judge Campbell or Judge Barry, where judges are elected officials and they are held to a heightened standard. And Judge Barry still received a state suspension, even though he was a judge and even though the same mitigation is not present. And for that, those reasons, we respectfully suggest that the appropriate sanction here is a fully stayed 6-month suspension.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.
Thank you, Your Honors.